This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I was the only staff member who decided that would harm my aches and pains even worse than my aches and pains are already harmed.
You mean you're the only mature member of the staff?
Oh, I hate that word.
Now, here's your host.
Hello, this is your host, Michelle Gininger of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net, sitting in for Mike Petrelli, who is sticking it to the man in Ohio. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the skeet shooting master, Dara Z. Handler.
I almost wanted to let that go, but it's actually a total lie. I stink. I have no depth perception. I was not good.
But you're the researcher and you're a physics magician. You should have gotten them all. Nine out of nine.
You'd think so. You'd also think that I'd be really good at things like pool and darts and other things where physics is important, but the depth perception thing, I'm not good at spatial orientation. Although you did pretty well.
I did. So what we're talking about is last week we went on our staff retreat in Warrenton, Virginia, and we did some skeet shooting as an entire staff. And I have to say the communications team held up their end of the bargain. The research team, you guys should stick with STATA.
Yeah, we're a lot more comfortable with computers than firearms.
But Ohio, Team Ohio, where Mike is testifying right now in defense of Common Core, I think they outshine National.
Yeah, well, they were pretty good.
But that's enough on our Second Amendment skills. And now it's time to play Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, take it away.
In Fordham's latest report, entitled Right Sizing the Classroom, Making the Most of Great Teachers, author Mike Hansen finds that as the best teachers teach larger classes and the weakest teach progressively smaller ones, the net result is improved student learning for all students, not just those who moved. What are the potential implications of this research?
This is huge for two reasons. Number one, it is a relatively low-cost way to make a fairly substantial difference. Class size overages are common. You have one or two students more in this class, one or two fewer students in this class. And the only thing that this report found is that if you do that strategically rather than randomly, where if you know you're going to have a larger class by one or two or six students, you assign that to the more effective teacher and allow the less effective teacher to have fewer students, then you do see significant gains in learning. So this is a fairly easy fix and an inexpensive one, because a lot of time this wiggle room is still well within class size limits, and it's not something that needs to be negotiated. Which brings me to point number two, why this is a big deal, is that it's something that can be implemented at a school level without huge policy changes. So you don't need to change the state law in order to have strategic class size assignments. You just need to have a principal who is very aware of the effectiveness of the teachers in his building. Maybe not necessarily measured by the formal evaluation system, but the principal knows who the good teachers are and thinks strategically about assigning students to their classes.
It's definitely a really exciting prospect, but it's not happening anywhere. So how do we get the message out? We don't know of a single school district that does this.
Well, one of the things that we have to be clear about is that we're not advocating for bigger class sizes across the board, right? That there is perhaps some optimum class size number that maximizes student learning for everyone, and we still don't know what that is, and that's the magic bullet that people are looking for. Really, what we're saying is that even if you can't have the optimal class size of every teacher gets 12 students, maybe that's the best, and for financial constraints, you can't do that. But even if financially you need to have an average class size of 25, then you work with that and you say that, you know, your more effective teachers will have 28 and your less effective teachers will have 22. And it's a hard thing for people to swallow because you're still pushing for bigger class sizes. So unfortunately, it's not maximizing the potential of every of those most effective teachers, but it's balancing it out so that their effectiveness is optimized across all of the students.
And this really takes it from a focus on the teachers to a focus on students and student achievement. I think the big problem here, though, communications-wise, is it's all about small classes. Everyone always talks about we want small classes. Private schools sell to parents, we have small classes. So how can we say public policy wise, oh, bigger classes, it's a better way of going. And I think the other problem here is you have your best teachers and you're giving them more work.
Well, you also don't want to admit that you have ineffective teachers at all, right? So you don't say, well, yeah, you're in a small class, it's because you have a bad teacher. But I think that you're right about the problem of giving teachers more work. One of the advantages to optimizing class sizes like this is that you have opponents of merit pay who don't want to pay teachers for being more effective directly. But this is an indirect way of rewarding your most effective teachers, but you're also simply paying your most effective teachers for doing more work, which we do already when a teacher teaches yearbook or coaches a sport or has more students in some districts, they do get paid more. And we're just making that determination strategically according to teacher effectiveness rather than randomly.
And I'm all for making decisions strategically instead of just making decisions. So let's go to number two.
Earlier this week, President Obama launched Youth Career Connect, a competitive grant program designed to better prepare high school students for high-tech careers. Some argue that the administration's affinity for competitive funding is wrong. What do you think?
I mean, I feel bad for the administration right now. They're just, you know, having a whole lot of trouble across the board. And the grants, this grant program's the least of their problems. But it seems to me that these issues are actually have the ability to pass through Congress. So I don't know if going around Congress is the best way. What do you think, Dara?
I completely agree. So the Youth Career Connect, this high-tech career preparation, is also covered by the Carl Perkins Act, which is in the process of reauthorization. And so you're absolutely right. Right, that this is kind of an attempt to end around Congress. And one of the things that the House committee was recently discussing this, the House Committee for Education and the Workforce. And one of the things that they pointed out is part of the what would make your grant competitive under the this Obama policy is partnering with business. So if your school can prove that you have a partnership with some local business or industry, then you have a better chance of getting the money. This is a big problem in areas that are already economically depressed, where the point is that they don't actually have businesses that they can partner with. And so it makes them less competitive for this type of grant. And these are the areas that perhaps need this type of grant more so that they can better prepare their high school students, because their other systems for preparing high school students for high tech careers just aren't there. And so, you know, if this can operate in parallel with a formula funding program, then competition isn't necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, we don't want to leave out areas that aren't able to compete.
On that note, let's move on to question number three.
The DOJ said Tuesday that it is no longer attempting to block Louisiana's school voucher program and, instead, it would limit its intervention to a yearly demand for information on children using vouchers. Is this a win?
I wouldn't say it's a win for voucher supporters, but I would say it's a loss for the Obama administration. I mean, I think the Department of Justice completely overstepped here. I mean, they're using federal DSEG orders to try to run around a program that they're clearly not a fan of. But as the data showed, this was, you know, three or four students that were moving, and, you know, the percentages of what they have to meet for the DSEG orders were barely changing. And it was clearly a political move. And everyone was against the administration doing this. People who don't even believe in private school choice necessarily saw this as an overstep. And I think the Obama administration has gone on and on about trying to end voucher programs, whether it's here in DC or Louisiana. They just realized it's not worth the time and fight. So it looks bad for the administration in that they spent time and money and publicity doing this, but they get no win out of it.
I mean, I think, you know, I definitely agree with you. And taking a look at the bigger picture of this idea of providing information on children using vouchers. On the one hand, it's a fair compromise, but data collection is only step one of transparency. And so, you know, you recognize that the whole fight here is using public money for private school. And if you collect the data, that does put the onus on somebody to actually make that data available. You cannot assume that parents are the primary consumers of this data, especially when it's provided to them in the raw form. And so I just, you know, be cautious here from a data standpoint, not necessarily a political one, but to be cautious here from a data standpoint and not assume that simply collecting the information is a step towards transparency and even accountability.
I completely agree. I mean, here at Fordham, we're all about accountability and private school choice and choice in general. And the Louisiana voucher program is incredibly accountable. I mean, if the schools don't make the correct scores, they get kicked out of the program. Parents are provided with a ton of information. And there are a lot of other programs that don't have enough accountability, and all evidence, well, there is no evidence on them because we have no idea how many students are participating even. Go after those programs to get more accountability. Don't go after the most accountable program in the country.
Agreed. I just hate to set a precedent that simply collecting the data is enough.
But I would counter you saying, I agree with that, but let's do it at the state level, not the federal level.
I would agree.
Well, we're all in agreement.
There we go.
Look at that. That's all the time we have today. Thanks, Pamela. It's now time for Amber's Research Minute. Welcome to the show, Amber.
Thanks, Michelle.
So we were talking about the staff retreat earlier. How did you do on the skeet shooting?
I did not skeet shoot. I was the only staff member who decided that would harm my aches and pains even worse than my aches and pains are already harmed.
You mean you're the only mature member of the staff?
Oh, I hate that word. But anyway, yeah.
Mature in a, we aren't obsessed with Twitter. I am
yeah,
a real
but
grown-up.
I cheered on everyone. I was there for moral support. But I kept looking at the gun, like jamming into everybody's shoulder and deciding that my shoulder already hurt and it would perhaps not be a good idea to have the gun jam into it.
Well, let's be real. The hot chocolate was by far the best part anyway.
Yeah, the hot chocolate with the marshmallows. I had a unnormal proportion there between chocolate and marshmallows, I will admit it.
And then I put the chocolate in the bottom and it melted. And you got a big glob of chocolate in the bottom.
It was great.
Woo! Great. Nice.
All right. Well, what do you have for us today?
We have a new study out by Dan Goldhaber, who is a podcast listener, dedicated podcast listener.
Well, we'll find out if he emails us
right.
And tells us about it.
And colleagues called Are There District Cross-District Effects in Teacher Contract Provisions? It sounds a little wonky, but it's interesting. It examines whether the restrictiveness of a district's bargaining contract is influenced by spillover from contracts in a nearby district. In other words, do district contracts start resembling one another simply because the districts are close to each other? The theory is that district agreements might come to resemble one another because they compete for teachers and there may be an impulse to codify working conditions. At least that's one theory. Analyst code CBA in 270 public school districts in Washington State, 633 different provisions. Wow. Findings on bottom line, they find that districts have similar levels of restrictiveness if they are within about 50 miles of one another. But more importantly, they also find that the bargaining structures influence consistency of bargaining provisions. In other words, districts have these things called educational service districts that sort of give bargaining support and a bunch of other services to districts. And unions have this thing called Uniserves that provide union bargaining help to multiple unions. So they find that actually those structures that are kind of behind the scenes are what's driving some of these similarities mm-hmm. and differences that we see in collective bargaining agreements. And what we maybe used to think was the geographic distance that was making some of these contracts begin to resemble each other is actually these structures that are, you know, leading to some consistency. Why do we care? Why is this important? Because sort of if you know the channels sort of behind these CBAs that are influencing how they look the way they look, then obviously you can start to concentrate on maybe trying to influence those structures. So that's kind of the bottom line. I mean, if you remember, that's the end of my official minute and a half. But if you remember NCTQ about a year ago, well, it's been longer than that. 3 years ago? My memory's awful. You guys remember this report called Invisible Ink?
Yes.
Okay. That was 3 years ago?
Yes.
Yes, something like that. Anyway, they were talking about how, you know, you need to get to the state level because you want to codify, the unions want to codify these things. They enshrine it in state statute. And sort of, and this kind of reminded me of that report and that now we're talking about sort of an intermediary kind of structure that we might be able to use to influence CBA provisions. Yeah. Anyway,
interesting.
Well, props to Dan and his team because I've been waiting for someone to do this geographical analysis for years. And it requires two things. Number one, you have to be able to geocode or location code all of your districts. And then number two, you have to code all of the contracts in the state and most of the provisions in them. So I understand why it hadn't been done up to this point, but I've been waiting for somebody to do this analysis. And I think it is incredibly valuable. You know, it's exactly like you said, that there are many things sort of behind the scenes that influence what goes into a contract. District officials sometimes will get training from one parent organization on how to negotiate. Same thing with unions. You know, they don't, the union president doesn't automatically know how to negotiate. They go to training, and trainings are put on by these local structures in Washington, in California. The State Teacher Association will provide local trainings for a bunch of districts. And so just seeing what behind the scenes mechanisms might be influencing contracts is, I think, super critical. So kudos to this research.
Yeah. And I think there are about like 10 grad students named who helped decode all these things.
Those poor grad students. But they, you know, they learned some valuable lessons, and maybe they'll get to write their own research one day.
Yeah. I mean, we always talk about these things don't change, or they don't change enough. And, you know, yeah, it's kind of interesting. You've got these other players that we don't hardly ever talk about that are sort of, I don't know, have this culture of how things are going to look, and they're able to influence, you know, multiple districts and a lot of teachers. And yeah, I mean, I don't know whether there's any possibility that reformers could sort of, you know, work with these structures instead of trying to, you know, work through, you know, typical union or district management, you know, because they're kind of a level up. And I think they probably purposely stay behind the scenes. So anyway, it was new information.
It's another level to the quagmire of education governance.
I think it's going to be interesting, too, to see what else they can do with the information that they've collected. One of the areas that I have done some work in is looking at teacher incentives. So if you pay, if a district offers an extra incentive, say, for a special education teacher, because they find that hard to staff, is that effective in recruiting and retaining special education teachers? And the answer we found is sometimes, but maybe they're just going to the district next door that doesn't offer your extra $1,000 for your special education credential, but just has higher salaries across the board.
But wouldn't you think, because I was interested in this statement made in the paper, they were talking about there's an impulse then to sort of make the contracts similar. But wouldn't you think if they're competing for teachers, they'd want the contracts to be different?
I don't necessarily know if the districts themselves see them competing for teachers with neighboring districts. And, you know, from the district standpoint, really, it's on their list of priorities. But remember, the contracts don't really change all that much from year to year. It's more subtle. And I think that they're, you know, for the most part, primarily interested in things like balancing the budget.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Till next week.
I'm Dara Z. Handelar.
And I'm Michelle Gininger for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.